Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Since before statehood, Black Alaskans have made contributions both big and small to shape Alaska into what it is today. February is Black History Month, and we want to celebrate and hear about prominent Black community leaders around the state. We'll discuss unsung Black figures in the 49th state throughout Alaska's history and those making an impact today on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
In rural Alaska communities, village public safety officers make a difference every day. Hired regionally, VPSOs are trained in public safety services such as community policing, fire prevention, life-saving emergency medical response, and search and rescue. VPSO receive competitive pay, benefits, and opportunities for advancement. To start your career in public safety and learn more about becoming a VPSO, go to vpso.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by VPSO.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning. It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Wesley Early, filling in for Lori Townsend. And today we're talking about unsung Black Alaskans. You know, I'm not very old, but thinking back to school discussions in Anchorage of history, especially around this time of year, I recall learning a lot about civil rights movements in the lower 48, you know, for Black History Month, Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, maybe John Lewis. But in Alaska, where Black people make up only 3% of the population, it can be hard to grasp the impact that Black people have made. Luckily, we've got three guests today who have documented prominent Alaskans both historically and more contemporarily, and even a guest who's lived through a lot of Black Alaska history. I'll start first with Ian Hartman. Hartman is a historian with the University of Alaska Anchorage who recently published the book Black Lives in Alaska, A History of African Americans in the Far Northwest. Hello, Ian.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Writing the foreword to that book was Cal Williams. Cal is a longtime community advocate who used to be the head of the Anchorage NAACP. Hello, Cal.
Good morning. How are you?
And also joining us is Jovell Rennie. Rennie is the creative lead for Black in Alaska, a multimedia project with the Rasmussen Foundation, spotlighting what it means to be Black and living in Alaska. Hi, Jovell.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And listeners can join the conversation at home as well. As we aim to spotlight unsung Black Alaskans, we'd love to know if there are any Black community members who are prominent in your part of the state. You can give us a call statewide, 1-800-478-8255, or in Anchorage, you can call 907-550-8422. We are also checking our emails. You can send those at talk@alaskapublic.org. And before we get going, I should note that I did first meet Jovell when he interviewed me for the Black in Alaska Project, so that's out of the way. I don't think that Jovell and I are in Ian's book, so we shouldn't have a problem there. Oh, is Jovell in the book?
He's got some photos.
Oh, great. Well,
cool.
I guess I'm the only one who's not in the book. with that disclosure out of the way, I'd like to start with Cal. The first time I met you, you were actually doing a presentation at UAA for Black History Month. And one section I really loved, you were talking about local Black history makers, and you mentioned John Parks. And I'd love to get things started with, you know, for listeners who are unaware, tell us a bit about Mr. Parks.
Oh, my goodness, John Parks. The man was fantastic. He lived about five blocks from me in the Fairview area. He had a house at 10th and Latouche at the time that I was living at 13th and Carlick. One day, he needed a ride to a Democratic meeting and came by, and I gave him the ride thinking I was just going to drop him off and take away. He said, come on in. We went, and they were charging $10 to get into the meeting. John objected, saying that was a poll tax, and you can't keep us out of here for the $10. He raised so much ruckus till he allowed us in without paying the $10. But John kept talking about and pushing for other issues that were of concern to the Fairview area, concern to people of color. next thing I knew, he had got into altercations with the president. Then he pushed and nominated me to become the president, and I did. So from that interaction with Mr. Parks, I watched him over the years, and he was basically a mentor for me. He was a godfather to a great number of people. His mother, his wife, rather, was a child care provider. And so as a result, they had great influence on a number of young people. But John Parks was an advocate for voter education and public transportation. One of the things that he really was passionate about, public transportation, and he fought for it, advocated for it, wore the mayor, George Sullivan, down, and was allowed to get 12-passenger vans, which was the beginning of the People Mover. And so John Parks is the father of public transportation, and the transit center out on Tudor is named after John S. Parks.
I was going to say, I think they just named, you know, the father of the People Mover. Not a lot of people know. You're riding the bus. Black Alaskan was the prominent person pushing that. And, you know, Cal, I'm wondering if you can talk a little about the early days of the Anchorage NAACP. I understand Mr. Parks was a part of it. Blanche McSmith, who was the first black woman to serve in the legislature, was part of it and one of the founders with you. Talk about that early part of the NAACP in Anchorage and what you guys were really advocating for.
Well, there was a man named Alvin Campbell who was working down at the railroad by day. And at night, he was building a home up in Rogers Park, which was up on the hill there off of Fireweed. And I say up on the hill because most of the people live down in that lower area where Shiloh is, called the East Chester Flats. It was muddy land down in there, unimproved land that didn't have running water or electricity. This Mr. Campbell had the audacity to buy a lot up on high ground in a place called Rogers Park. And the Gatling brothers, two guys from Texas who lived up there, said, "Bye, you can build that house, but you ain't never gonna live in it." And true to their word, they burned the house to the ground. Mr. Campbell got with John Parks, Joe Jackson, Blanche McSmith, the Watts family, Richard Watts, the Coleman family, Flossie and Clarence Coleman. They appealed to New York, where the NAACP's headquarters was at the time, and were granted a charter. And so the NAACP was born in Anchorage, Alaska in 1951 as a result of John Parks and Mr. Campbell, whose home was burned.
And, you know, I know that a lot of that history is kind of running simultaneously, I think, to the lower 48 civil rights movement. But were there some ways that maybe it was more localized? And maybe, Ian, you could weigh in on that as well, like where there were local issues that really were pushing the NAACP.
Well, we did have kind of a interaction with the lower 48. At the time Medgar Evers was killed, there was a big demonstration here in Anchorage, largely by the NAACP, in sympathy with that, and they raised funds and sent them to Mississippi as a result of that.
The only thing I would add is that there was a long push to get an NAACP chapter up here, and because we're talking early 50s pre-statehood, the New York-based office didn't want to do it because it was a territory, and so there were some similar pushes even in, you know, places like Puerto Rico and Hawaii, and a woman named Madeline Holmes was really taking the lead effort on this kind of early on in the 1940s, and if you go to the NAACP branch office archives, which are housed at UC Berkeley, you can see this kind of acrimonious exchange between some people up here and some folks in New York. And it is indeed the Campbell House arson, the arson attack, call it what it is, that pushes the NAACP in New York to really recognize the kind of quote-unquote issues that are going on in Anchorage and then to charter the branch.
Well, we're talking unsung Black Alaskans here on Talk of Alaska. If you've got someone in your community you think deserves some recognition, feel free to give us a call. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. In Anchorage, you can call 907-550-8422 or email us talk@alaskapublic.org. I'd like to pivot to Jovell. You've been working on this project, Black in Alaska, for a few years now. Can you walk me through sort of this running joke that in some ways led to the project coming about?
Yeah, there's a, for some years, there's been a running joke by P. Diddy, actually. He said there's no black people in Alaska. I can't remember the exact context, but when he found out that there were, in fact, black people in Alaska, he had sort of this outlandish response. He was in disbelief. And that joke has kind of moved its way through different communities for a while. And so we, you know, myself and some folks at the Rasmussen Foundation, through just like casual conversation, we started thinking like, well, what if we did a project that kind of like pushed back at that? It's like, yo, they're not just black people in Alaska. Like, there are black people thriving in Alaska in every corner of the state. So from there, a couple of meetings later, the assembly of the committee, the project was born.
And I'm curious, you know, you've talked about how, you know, in a lot of ways, black communities in the lower 48 aren't homogenous. You know, you've got sort of East Coast black people, you've got Southern black people, people on the West Coast, you know, maybe less populated areas in like the Midwest. You know, talk a little bit about like the how Alaska's kind of different from that, and that there is sort of a shared experience among black people who come to the state, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, we've talked before about how in the lower 48, there tends to be like sort of a regional blackness wherever you go. But up here, it's just a melting pot of blackness. Like, we are all united in that shared experience. We're all cold, you know, so we got that in common. But we're just happy to see each other for the most part. You know, we're like happy to be here, happy to see each other, and happy to work together. And we share in that experience. And even though, you know, you might be from the East Coast or I might be from the South or whatever have you, there's still much more overlap. We still have much more things in common than we do differences. And we're united by those things that we share.
Well, I'd like to sort of step back in history a bit. Early Alaska history has a lot to do with the military. And I'm super interested in this odd period of time in Skagway during the Gold Rush, where black soldiers essentially kept the peace in the area for a few years. Ian, can you talk a bit about Company L? I think it was like 1899 area?
Exactly. Yeah. So we could even go back a bit farther in terms of whalers and some gold miners who came up, you know, at the beginning of the Gold Rush. But the real first that I think I can identify major presence of African Americans would have been with Company L, as you just described. And so by the time you kind of get into the Gold Rush era, of course, Skagway is the staging ground, not the only staging ground, but one of the primary staging grounds for stampeders and settlers to make their way up to the Yukon River, up to Dawson and the gold fields. And so all of these towns are kind of the, you know, the quintessential old West boom towns. And so there's a lot of lawlessness. There's a lot of these places are a little bit out of control. And so Skagway is very much so in the throes of the Gold Rush by, you know, 1898 and 1899. And as it's kind of petering out, Company L, which is a company of the 24th Infantry, which was a Buffalo Soldier unit. These are black soldiers. They come in and they're really tasked with kind of stabilizing the town. And if not for Company L, you know, one kind of wonders what would have been the fate of Skagway. I mean, it was a rough and tumble frontier town, and it's making this transition to more of a stable settlement community. There are tensions between white settlers and the indigenous Chilkat Tlingit, and it's really Company L's task to make sure that some of those tensions don't boil over. And so right through 1902, they're the authority. They're the authority in town. And in fact, you know, a lot of them will stay. I shouldn't say a lot of them. A few of them will stay afterwards and then try their hand up in the various gold mining districts. And so it's to me, I think it's kind of a turning point in the Gold Rush in general is a turning point in the history of Alaska. But I would say it's kind of a turning point in the history of African-American settlement in Alaska as well.
And is there much documentation about sort of what those soldiers face? You know, you talk about how there was already animosity between, you know, the settlers there and the indigenous people. But, you know, what did they think of the black soldiers who showed up?
So the settlers, you know, I mean, a lot of them who just as Javel was talking about, I mean, you know, these are folks who are coming from all over the country. And so they're bringing with them their prejudices and their biases and their racism. And so the soldiers kind of encounter a whole range of hostilities from the settlers. At the same time, they also do work with a lot of them too. And I think over time, they start to work together and realize that if we're going to kind of establish a community here. We're going to have to work together on this. And there certainly are some moments of tension. There's a famous time when the YMCA was segregated and white only, and there's a push to desegregate it. And eventually, there will be African Americans. The men of Company L will kind of hang out there, and it's this community center. You could imagine these places. There aren't really many places to gather as community, so the places there are pretty much celebrated. And so, the YMCA is one of them. And so there are certainly the vestiges of segregation and Jim Crow that are imported to Alaska, and then there are moments of people working together.
And you know, a couple decades later, there's a really interesting figure who pops up named Tom Bevers, who, for those of you who don't know, he's kind of a formative role in the creation of the Ferrandi. But his background and his family history was kind of a mystery to Anchorage residents up until his funeral. Like, can you talk a little bit about why? What people didn't know about Tom Bevers?
Well, the people of Anchorage didn't know that he was black. we could probably start with that. I mean, he was one of many people who passed. You know, we're talking about the 19-teens and 20s. This was what some historians will call like the nadir of race relations following World War I, the 1920s, the rise of the second KKK. So this is a really brutal time in American history of American race relations. And so it shouldn't be too surprised that somebody whose ancestry would have really limited his opportunities, would have claimed a white identity. And so Bevers at the time is in Anchorage, and he's one of these people who has a lot of clout in the community. He's one of the first paid fire chief. He, as you pointed out, is someone who is an initial investor in the property that will become the Fur Rendezvous. He's really a leading figure in the town. And again, as you point out, it's only when he passes away in an accident. He stumbles across and goes, I think he kind of broke his leg out in the wilderness and just was unable to make a recovery from it. And his sister comes up from Virginia, and she is considerably darker complected than he is. And so people start to kind of scratch their heads. Wait a minute here. And so at that point in time, they realized that this leading figure in Anchorage through the 20s and 30s is indeed African American. And it was unexpected, but they ended up, of course, kind of celebrating him nonetheless. And today you can find his headstone in the cemetery just off to the east of downtown.
Wow. Well, we'll get on to my next interesting person I want to talk about. But right now we've got Melanie calling in from Chugiak, who wants to highlight another prominent Black Alaskan. Hi, Melanie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. So who would you like to spotlight?
Ashley Dickerson.
What can you tell us about Ashley?
Well, I want to say she was the first Black Alaskan to have a homestead out in the Matsu Valley in the late 1950s. And she was also the first Black lawyer in Alaska.
Wow. Cal, did you know Ashley?
I did. She lived about four blocks from me there in Fairview. And I had various relations with her. She was involved with the NAACP every time we had a problem that we wanted a legal answer on. And I was a member of the Palm Springs UNP and Health Spa, the very first athletic health club that we had here. And I received a burn in the sauna. We couldn't come to an agreement, filed a lawsuit. I walked into court with Bob Wagstaff, who was Jewish, as my lawyer. They came in with M. Ashley Dickerson as their lawyer. So we had that adversarial trial, and then we had talks days later about it and stuff, and she had insisted that I show that part of my body which had been burned, and why is it so important? I said, I'm on my way to Hollywood, and I need, to look good. She said, you're going to show that part of your body in these movies, Mr. Williams? So M. Ashley Dickerson and I have a great relationship.
Oh, man. Well, I... I didn't know that going in. And I know, Ian, you'd also written about Ashley, how she didn't just sort of break ground in Alaska, right? She had sort of hopped around several states and become among the first black lawyers, right?
Yeah, the first black woman to like pass the bar. I hesitate to use kind of words like pass the bar in Alabama, because you could imagine the kind of barriers that would have been put up for a black woman in Alabama. But nonetheless, she's considered to be the first kind of empowered female attorney, black female attorney in Alabama. Again, at the height of Jim Crow, decides that's not for her, goes to Indiana, where I think she's like the second, makes her way to the Pacific Northwest and eventually up to Alaska. Absolutely brilliant person who everybody needs to know more about.
Well, nice to know she was a very good lawyer in making sure that Cal had accurate injuries from a burn. Melanie, thank you.
Understanding her relationship with Cal. Sorry about that.
Yeah. Let me add, though, she was a childhood friend and classmate of Rosa Parks. And Rosa Parks came up here, and the two of them looked very similarly. And so that's another note that should be noted.
Tell me about Rosa Parks being alive. Like, I was going to talk about something else, but Rosa Parks coming to Alaska, I've never heard that.
Yeah, I can't remember the year, but it was part of the NAACP's doing, and she did come here. And so that was when we saw she and M. Ashley together. We thought, oh man, this is amazing. These two ladies, yeah.
Well, there's another person I'd like to highlight, sort of. I'm not sure on the timeline. I think it's sort of the late 60s when Zula Swanson becomes very prominent. You know, in your book, Ian, you note this period of time in the late 60s where Ebony Magazine, which for our listeners who don't know, is still a very prominent magazine, but at the time, very prominent magazine in the African-American community, highlighting this sort of bonanza for blacks, talking about these job opportunities. And Swanson was, and I have to make a note, this is a direct quote from the time, called Alaska's Richest Black by Ebony. Can you talk about that time period and how Swanson fit into it? I know that Anchorage's nightlife was maybe a little seedier than it is today.
Yeah, maybe so. I'll defer to Dr. Williams on some of his experiences with Zula Swanson at the time, but she was, this is pre-oil, so this is, you know, before I think some of the real considerable wealth comes into the state. But I mean, there's reason to believe that she was indeed among the richest people, right? Big property holder in what is Midtown today, the Goose Lake area, which was where she had her house, just kind of feet from where we are right now. She got her start in prostitution and ended up getting into real estate and parlayed that into various business ventures, and was just an exceptional entrepreneur, and was somebody who navigated the worlds of kind of white business men in Anchorage, but then also was kind of skillfully able to, you know, be a presence in the black community. And anything you'd want to add to that, Cal?
Well, she was indeed very active with political matters as well. She's one of the people who founded and was working with the establishment of the NAACP. She owned the land at, Dr. Hardman said, downtown. Let's say it was right where Penny's is currently. She owned that whole block in there. She owned Goose Lake, the lake itself, as well as having a home on it, and gave that property to the city so that they could establish the Goose Lake Park that is there. And just over the Egan Center, there is a huge, big white structure there. It was a penthouse apartment building that she owned and built, had a swimming pool in it, had thrones for commodes, and that building is still there to this very day, overlooking the Egan Center. Zula Swanson and Cora Green, a friend of hers, were instrumental in buying the property out off of Lake Otis from 36 up to Pine, which is now called Green Acres after Cora Green. So she was indeed a prominent business lady and very astute in her desires to improve the lives of black people.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised. I mean, you know, that I think that part of Alaska history I'm not super familiar on, especially pre-oil. You know, do you know much about how she was able to sort of, I know she started out in prostitution and ended up becoming a madam. You know, how does that sort of translate into, well, I mean, is it as simple as, you know, prostitutes were in high demand in Alaska at the time? I mean, how does that parlay?
Well, that is true, but her clientele was among some of the movers and shakers, bankers and politicians of the time. And, you know, I won't name them because some are still alive, but they indeed were, you know, engaging with her and not only giving her money, but giving her advice on investments and stuff. So.
And, you know, I was going to get to this later, but since we're talking about this really interesting moment in Anchorage history, Cal, I'd love for you to talk about the Mermaid Room and this sort of nightlife scene in Anchorage at the time. This is still during a period of redlining and sort of forced segregation in Anchorage, right?
Indeed. A guy named Danny Gibson owned the Mermaid Room, and it was where we have the fire department downtown on 4th Avenue. That property right in there where that fire station is was owned by this Danny Gibson, and he had a club called the Mermaid Room, and it had a big crystal mermaid over the bar. Some of the entertainers that came through at the time were Lou Rawls, Etta James, Jimmy Smith, the organist, and Joe Louis, who was the heavyweight champion of the world, came through and was there. I even sang in there a time or two. But that club was wonderful. It would stay open until 5 a.m., close from 5 to 6, and open again at 6 o'clock. So in between that time, we'd run over to Leroy's Pancake House, get refreshed, and come back again to party hardy.
I'm kind of wondering, you know, Ed, you know, for someone of Etta James's caliber to come through Anchorage at that time seems like you had to have some connect, you know, because I don't know that an Etta James, you know, Beyonce would come through Anchorage anytime soon, you know, like, you know, if her tour people are listening, you know, maybe bring a show through. But, you know, someone like Etta James to come through Anchorage, that's kind of especially like early statehood.
Indeed, it was the craziest thing. In fact, I have a poster. Brooke Benton came through and I looked and it said $10 cover charge. So, you know, these were wonderful times and these people were. Some of them were at the height of their career, and some had, you know, gotten into the middle, but most of them were still pretty hot when they came through Anchorage. Anchorage was a jumping town.
Can you talk about how, like, some of the redlining and the districting sort of, it made these sort of prominent black communities that we still see today?
Well, we talked earlier about the flats, the Eastchester area down by Shiloh Church, and that was the only place allowed that would sell to African Americans, and then later Fairview up on the hillside. But when I bought my home in 1980, which is in Airport Heights, it had been purchased previously by a friend of mine's mother. She bought it in 1970. Both she and I signed the documents that were presented to us by the bank, sign here, initial here, etc. 10 years after I had done all of that and was in the house, about 1990, I read the papers that I had signed, one of which was a covenant that said none other than members of the Caucasian race can own or occupy housing in this area. That was Airport Heights. And even to this very day, where I live, there is not another black for some 7 blocks.
Wow. Yeah, it's really, and you know, so you essentially bought a house that, had you bought it maybe 10 years before, that would have been an enforced policy that you couldn't have bought it.
Well, it wasn't really enforced very well. What happened was a company came in and built that area in 1970, and for the longest of time, there was very few or none, no blacks in there at all, and Mrs. Lavige went and cried in the office, and the guy sold to her and had sold to another black family down who he knew, but they were the only two blacks in there for the longest of time. Now, we didn't know about the covenant, and I didn't know about it for 10 years after I had bought the house, but that pattern of segregation and redlining occurred not only there, but elsewhere. I told you about Cora Green buying Green Acres. But at the time, the people in Geneva Woods erected a cyclone fence that separates Geneva Woods from Green Acres to this very day. If you're on Lake Otis going south, take a right on 38th, you go 4 blocks, and it dead ends against this cyclone fence, the wall of apartheid.
And that's still there in Geneva Woods. Wow. Well, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back to discuss unsung Black Alaskans when Talk of Alaska continues. Stay with us.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Money is generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Sustaining membership offers public media greater financial stability month to month, so consider making a sustaining gift to this station. Thank you.
And we're back. This is Talk of Alaska, and the topic today is unsung Black Alaskans. If there is a Black community member in your side of the state that you'd like to highlight, you can give us a call. The statewide number is 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, you can call 907-550-8422 or email us at talkofalaska.org. We do have a caller in the line. We've got Frank from Ninilchik. Frank, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I just was calling to mention Captain Michael A. Healy, the captain of the Bear, the revenue cutter. He was the son of an African-American slave, Eliza, and an Irish plantation owner, Michael Morris Healy. And he was born in 1839, and he, quote, was one of this country's best Arctic navigators. And it was the day 1886. He was a captain. It was the first revenue cutter to run up the coast all the way to Utqiagvik. And he's a noteworthy.
Yeah, I see.
History.
I see and Ian nodding his head.
Yeah, and you know, he passed for white, you could say. So it wasn't known at the time that he was born on a plantation, his family. So to show you the situation at the time, his family, his father and mother, they sent him north into the free country, and his siblings as well, and they were educated up there. And his siblings, some became professors in universities up north and so on. But he couldn't. Of course, divulge his race, or he wouldn't have been the captain of the Bear. So,
yeah,
it's important. There's an interesting book about it called "Steaming to the North" by Catherine C. Donahue and David C. Switzer that tells about the trip. It's fascinating.
Yeah,
there's a lot of photographs from the trip. And,
yeah, I really appreciate you bringing that up, Frank. Ian, you know, you talked a lot about sort of this early part of Arctic exploration and sort of the military is a big impact. You know, what can you say about Captain Healy?
Well, lots. He went by, well, I don't know if he went by, but he got the name Hellroarin' Mike. Hellroarin' Mike Healy, as the caller pointed out, he was in the Revenue Cutter Service, which is the forerunner to the Coast Guard. And he was known at the time as one of the most skilled navigators of the North Pacific and into the Arctic. And he was somebody who had a volcanic temper and didn't always have the best reputation with his crew, but he could really navigate the waters. And so he was able to probably stay on as a captain a bit longer than he should have, but there wasn't anyone else of comparable skill in getting into these waters, you know, across the Bering Strait, and had kind of a role in introducing reindeer across the Bering Strait into Western Alaska, and pretty fascinating guy, and he his career spans, you know, a good 30 plus years on the waters of the North Pacific and the Arctic. Again, as the caller pointed out, like Thomas Bevers, he was another fellow who passed, always claimed his Irish ancestry, but not his African ancestry. And again, the reason is fairly obvious. He wouldn't have been able to have the position that he did, you know, claiming his African ancestry.
Sure. And, you know, one of the things that this show is also about highlighting is sort of contemporary Black Alaskans. And, you know, Jovell, I'd love to pivot to you and hear about the breadth of experiences that you'd heard from your interviews. You know, were you surprised at all about sort of the similarities and sort of differences among people that you spoke to in different parts?
Not necessarily surprised. I think what's really interesting is to see how like across industries, Black people will find a way. You know, I think now we're fortunate that we don't have as many hurdles as we did, but the hurdles do still exist. So no, I'm never really surprised when I hear about a person excelling in their industry. If anything, it's kind of uncommon to hear about a Black person not being great at it because we have to work so much harder in certain areas.
And one thing that I'm interested about is, you know, Alaska's got like 3% of its population is Black. And, you know, it strikes me that, and I think, Ian, you've mentioned this, that in a lot of ways, you know, it wasn't great, as we, you know, Cal noted, there was segregation, there was, you know, issues of racism. But in a lot of ways, the Black experience in Alaska was different than the one in the lower 48 in terms of like opportunity. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, I'd amplify what Jovell just said. I mean, you know, despite the low population, there's kind of excellence across the segments of Alaska life. And so, you know, those opportunities begin as early as the, you know, pre-treaty of session, right? So, I mean, you've got whalers who are here and gold miners who are here. I highlight St. John Atherton, who comes up as a gold miner and ends up with some money that he's able to help fund what would become the Tuskegee Institute, this kind of esteemed institution of Black learning. Bessie Kutcher, the first known Black entrepreneur, female entrepreneur in Alaska, who, you know, mines the miners. It's tend to do a lot better in mining when you're setting up a restaurant or something that you can actually kind of get the money from the miners as opposed to going out and working a claim yourself. And so there's that deeper history. And I think kind of across the board, what you see is this population just punching way above its weight, so to speak.
Yeah, and you know, Jovell, we've talked about sort of Black and Alaska profiles. We were trying to get R.C. Woodson on today. That didn't happen, but he's the latest profile that you guys have released. Talk to me a little about R.C. You know, I understand you've known him since you were a kid, and to profile him must have felt like this whole full circle moment.
100%. Yeah, I've known R.C. Since I was like maybe 13 or 14. And since I've known him, he has been just about anything that he is doing. I think currently he's the chief information officer for Bristol Bay Native Corporation. I can't remember off the top of my head, but RC, for as long as I've known him, he's done concert promotion, he's done mentorship, he's done all sorts of stuff, he's done coaching.
So is he a pageant judge?
Yeah, he was a pageant judge too. But it was kind of full circle to be like, oh man, like not only am I just meeting people on this project, which has been great, but I'm also reconnecting with people that I've known for many years in my life and getting a chance to tell their stories that I might have known a little bit about. And even working with RC, like I learned so much about him that I hadn't known, even though this person was a figure in my life for a few years at the time.
Yeah, someone who you already understood their sort of prominence, at least from your perspective, and to go, you were way more prominent than I thought
you
were.
Like I knew he was that dude, but I was like, yo, you're really that dude.
And we're going to go back to the phones. We've got Charity calling in from Anchorage. Hi, Charity. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm going to give Cal a name here. He can help me remember a very fine, very active young man by the name of Jimmy Lockhart.
Cal is nodding his head. He remembers. What can you tell us about Jimmy, Charity?
Well, he was a Marine in World War II. He was a feisty fighter here for education of our youth, active apprentices for skill and training so you could make a living. I don't know if the military brought him here, but I'm so glad that he did end up here. He was head of the minority contractors here, was on their national board and things, but he was one of those very, very active, intense, quiet person. and at least in my relationship with him, but he's outstanding, and he should be remembered.
Yeah, Cal, what can you say?
Well, he was quiet, but he was also noisy. Jimmy ran for lieutenant governor, and he lived in this Green Acres that we just mentioned, which is less than five blocks from here. His brother, Parnell Lockhart, is alive today. His daughter, Alicia Lockhart, is alive today. His sister was with Richard Watts, she was the second retail worker there at Cars Quality Center. So the Lockhart family, coming out of Louisiana, were indeed very active in social and political and economic activity here in Anchorage, Alaska.
Wow. Well, Charity, thanks so much for calling. We really appreciate that that reminder of the Lockharts. You know, Jovell, I'd like to switch back to you. You know, one of the reasons behind our show is to highlight sort of historical figures who may have gone unrecognized and sort of everyday change makers. What can you say about sort of the most memorable Black in Alaska profiles that you've done? I know you've traveled across the state to do these. You know, tell me about sort of those memorable profiles and the variety of experience that you really were able to find.
I think one of the more, can I share a memorable moment, I guess?
Sure, yeah.
When we were in Juneau with Sherry Patterson, the way she took our writer under her wing immediately, and this is before the cameras are rolling, before anything's going on, she just took a liking to her and immediately offered mentorship. And it was a beautiful moment to see a Black woman establishing her career, just instantly reaching out and offering a hand to a Black woman trying to establish herself in her career. Moments like going out to Haines and going for a hike with Chris Hill, you know, and just kind of walking through the woods, and she's telling us about how much she loves fly fishing and how that was something she never thought she would do as a younger person. You know, like, those moments are incredible.
Right. And what can you say about Chris Hill a bit? What's sort of her relationship in Haines? Like, what does she do?
I think she's the president of the Northwest branch of the Sierra Club.
Mm.
Yeah. Don't quote me on that. I might be wrong. But she's an avid outdoors woman. She's been to the outdoors for quite some time, and she's all about conservation.
You know, you were mentioning that Lockhart had run for lieutenant governor, and I wanted to ask about sort of, you know, some of the more sung heroes are definitely like, you know, the first politician to be of this background. And, you know, I know Betty Davis was, I believe, the first Black woman elected to the legislature. I think that Blanche was appointed, and then she was the first Black person to serve in the Senate. East Anchorage High School is now named after Ms. Davis. What can you tell me about sort of Betty Davis's early career in the state and sort of what led her to that higher office?
Oh, my goodness, another Louisiana product.
we should note that Cal Williams is also from Louisiana. So if you didn't know, he might drop a couple.
Drop them, yes. She came in from, again, Louisiana, and was involved in the health and social services area. And she was encouraged by a guy named Robert Boyd, who started a family reunification project here. And Robert has not received the accolades that he should for the work that he's done, and we're going to work on that. But Robert encouraged Betty to run first off for the State House, and then when she ran for Senate, he pushed her for that. Betty came from a smaller town in Louisiana than even I. Monroe, Louisiana, where I was some 50,000. She came from Bernice, Louisiana, which was out in the country and in the woods and little old school and stuff. And then let me talk about that Louisiana. In Louisiana, there is racism within the community. Dark-skinned people are not held as lofty as lighter-skinned Blacks, and Betty was dark in skin color. Betty went to Grambling, which was a teacher's college. Most of the other lighter-skinned people went to Southern University down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and it was university level. You could go there and become doctors and lawyers and all that. Grambling was a teacher's college where Betty went. So Betty came to Alaska with that attitude that I am going to succeed in spite of. And she carried, some say, a chip on her shoulder. And I say, yes, she did, and she carried it well. She demanded respect. She pushed for respect, not only for herself, but for others. And she loved children. So she was a strong advocate for child care, early childhood education, and again, working with social services program even before becoming a legislator. She was a strong advocate for early childhood education. And so when it was just kind of like a smooth transition for her to be concerned about education work, she was on the HESS committee, the Health Education and Social Services Committee, while in the legislature, and carried herself well in the fight that she did and is well deserved to have had Betty Davis East Anchorage High School named in her honor.
And I was also curious, you know, I'm not super familiar with if there was any overlap between Betty and Dr. Etheldra Davis. I don't think they were related, but do you know much about Etheldra?
I do. She and her daughter is still active here in Anchorage. Living in the Fairview area, small, you know, you encounter people, and she had me come over to the school and talk various times. She also headed the Neighborhood Watch Program with the APD, and I followed her in that step. So she and I had that relationship going. She was a strong, strong advocate for childhood education, and again, as you stated, was the first principal in the state of Alaska, and there again, well-deserved at Fairview Elementary School, which she was at, is named after her.
All right, well, we're going to go back to the phones. We've got Janelle calling from up in Barrow, Utqiagvik. Janelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I want to talk about a Betty. Her name was Betty Jean McDonald. This woman was, her voice was so incredible. It was, oh my, she had a mezzo-soprano voice. And I had the good fortune of meeting her after she had retired. But she sang for Pope John Paul when he came to Anchorage. She sang for Governor Sheffield, for Governor Knowles, what's the other governor? Jay Hammond. Mm-hmm. Her voice was so incredible. When she married her husband, their picture was featured, and this was in 1954, I believe. Their picture was featured in the public paper in Knoxville, Tennessee. That was unheard of for a black couple. That was unheard of for, especially 1954. But when I met her, and I met her through her daughter, I remember going to their house, and she said, "Come on, we're going over and have breakfast with Mom." I walked in. This is the mid-90s. There were three of the original Tuskegee Airmen sitting at her kitchen table having a conversation, and I was just blown away.
Is this in Anchorage?
In Anchorage, yes, in Anchorage. I can't remember the area where they lived, but it was in Muldoon. That much I remember. It was in Muldoon. And she taught at music at Wendler, at Clark, and at East High School. And finally at Bartlett, and I think about, maybe 8 or 9 years ago, it's been that long, they renamed their Performing Arts Center in Bartlett after Mrs. Mack. That's what they called her. And after I went to her memorial service, I came back to Barrow, and I was talking to one of my coworkers, and she goes, "Oh, Mrs. Mack, she was such a great teacher. She was my music teacher in high school." And I was like, whoa. But her voice was so incredible. And when I would go to church with them, I would sit between her and her husband, who had a grand bass voice, because they drowned out my noise. it was just a beautiful thing. And this woman was, her voice was so incredible. And she is one of those people who was deeply involved in the arts here in the state of Alaska. And she was also involved with the Covenant House, and she did a lot of public service work. She was named Mother of the Year in 1962. She was named one of the Outstanding Young Women of America in 1967. And she was given the Governor's Denali Award for Outstanding Service here in the state of Alaska in 2002. Just an incredible, incredible voice. And wow, I think she just did so much for the arts in the state of Alaska. So I just wanted to make sure that, you know, there may be some people out there who remember her because they've been here for a very long time.
Wow, yeah. And Cal definitely lit up when you mentioned her.
Yeah, I do. And I've got some photographs, but I need to get with you to get some of that data. So
Well, you can find her daughter at Bartlett High School. I believe she's still a teacher there. But yeah, Incredible.
Well, thanks.
Well, thank you so much, Janelle, for that. We're going to go back to the phones. We've got Lynette in Anchorage, who has another influential teacher she wants to talk about. Lynette, thanks for being on the show.
Well, thank you for letting me come on your show. And I know that Cal would know this teacher, Mr. Leo Jose. He taught fifth grade at Fairview Elementary back in 1969, and he was very influential. He was very kind. And not only did he teach us all the good educational info, but he also gave us a good, you know, real life kind of a feel on the current, you know, the current events of America and Alaska and what was going on within our communities. It was great. He was so kind.
Oh, man. Did you know Leo?
I did. And his father was the pastor of Greater Friendship Church. His sister, Carol, was also very active in housing here. And he's still around. So thanks for pointing him out.
Well, we're going to take another quick break, but we'll return with Talk of Alaska, talking about unsung Black Alaskans here in just a bit. Stay tuned.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. There are many ways to support your local public media station. Donate now and arrange to make a planned gift as a bequest. Your legacy will stretch from today to many tomorrows. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're here with Jovell Rennie, Ian Hartman, and Cal Williams. Jovell, I'd like to talk about sort of your takeaway from the Black in Alaska Project. You know, do you have any sort of hopes for, you know, what a project like this can really mean, not just, I think, to a community, but, you know, as we've talked about, you know, there are people who I was unaware of, you were unaware of, you know, not Cal. Cal knows everybody in Alaska, but Ian looked like even there were a couple of times where he was like, wow, I wrote the book on Black Alaskans. I didn't know about them. You know, what is your hope for sort of a project like Black in Alaska, what it can mean for sort of this history?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest takeaways for me is that there's no shortage of beautiful Black stories in Alaska. Like, there are Black people in every corner of the state, and they all have something great to say. My biggest hope is that people be empowered to tell their own stories, you know, use the media that they have at their disposal, whether that be a smartphone or just a conversation on the street, and tell those stories, share that family history, and just continue to just exist and thrive.
I'm curious, Ian, you know, as a historian, you know, I think that we've gotten in this time period where maybe, you know, certain history is being maybe resisted, you know, as more history comes out about, you know, maybe Alaska isn't the place that you always thought it was. You know, we've talked about ways in which Black people were not only influential, but also sort of stigmatized. You know, what is your hope for, you know, your book, you know, what is your hope for sort of using this history in a way to sort of maybe have a more fuller picture of Alaska?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think Javel hits it on the head. I mean, I've been working on this project with Cal and so many others in the community, and it's a small piece of the story. I mean, anything we can do, I think, to widen the lens of Alaska history, I think, is really so important. So there within any number of the people who we just talked about could really deserve their own biography. And so I think the important thing to remember here is just how many people's stories have not been told, and to the extent that we can empower people to get those stories into the public view, and that we can really kind of reorient our kind of history of Alaska to be more inclusive and to, you know, take full account of the people who have contributed in these really impactful ways, I think that should be our goal.
Well, we're going to go back to the phones. We've got Sean in Anchorage. Sean, thank you for joining the show.
Well, thank you. I was wondering if you could mention some of the Black athletes that have been in Alaska. For instance, Aaron Judge played for the Glacier Pilots in the Alaska Baseball League. Barry Bonds played a few games with the Bucks. I forget if it was Dave Parker or Dave Winfield, but one of them played for the Gold Panthers. And then there were the basketball players. Trajan Langdon from East High and Carlos Boozer from Juneau Douglas went on to be All-Americas at Duke and played in the NBA. And I can't remember, his name doesn't come to me right now, but there was another fellow from East High, that was All America, I think, at Kansas and went on to the NBA. And then George Foreman, the great boxer, used to train in Palmer. And I was wondering if you remember any of those.
I don't remember George Foreman in Palmer. I think the basketball player you're thinking of is Mario Chalmers, who actually went to Bartlett High School. I'm a Bartlett grad, okay. So we were very aware of Mario Chalmers when he won a couple championships with the Heat. But yeah, Ian was kind of nodding his head when you mentioned the Bucks.
I was just thinking of Dave Winfield was up here. Satchel Paige, interestingly enough.
Oh, Satchel Paige.
Yeah. In the twilight of his career, came up here and made some noise about potentially buying. I can't remember if it was the Bucks or the Glacial Pilots. I don't remember what Alaska League it was. But yeah, there's a really rich history that you've just put your finger on that probably deserves its own show.
Yeah, I know Trajan Langdon now is like the general manager for an NBA team. I can't remember which team. It might be the Pelicans.
The Pelicans, yep.
Yeah. It's really remarkable. That's very recent history that, you know, there have been prominent Black Alaskans. We've got a couple more minutes in the show left, and I'd like to sort of defer to Cal. You know, as somebody who has been kind of a witness to really a sizable chunk of African American history in Alaska, in Anchorage, I'm wondering, you know, what is your sort of outlook for the future? You know, why do you think it's important to highlight these figures as both maybe for knowledge sake, but also as like maybe lessons moving forward?
Someone put on my Facebook page today, is there a White History Month? And I said, no, there's 365 days of white history. His story was written by him, not her story. So the stories of people of color, all history is valuable, and I say it every presentation, and I'll say it here today, that no matter what your race, you have family history, as Jovell said, and treasure that history. You've got old photographs right on the back of them, who they were. Pass that information down to youngers. When we know our history, we are encouraged by the achievements and accomplishments and even the struggles that we've done. And when you know and have pride in who you are, you cannot be marginalized mentally. You can be held back, but you also know that people of your kind have done great accomplishments. So it's encouraging, and it's also therapeutic to know who you are and where you came from.
What do you mean by therapeutic?
There's trauma to have been told for years, you ain't nothing, you ain't gonna be nothing, you can't. That trauma is generational, and it is in people who feel, I don't have any hope because nobody ever did anything, and I'm told that I'm nothing, and I'm told that. So to overcome that, when you can look at the great accomplishments going all the way back to the pyramids and stuff and say, I am somebody, I'm Black and I'm proud, or whatever it takes to overcome. A friend of mine said, these Samoans, they walk around like they own the world. I said, hey, that could perhaps be an overcompensation for attitudes such as you just expressed.
Right. Yeah. I imagine that, you know, there's a certain sort of happiness in knowing that it was tough, but you're still here.
Right.
Well, we are approaching the end of our show, and I'd like to thank our guests, Jovell Rennie, who is the creative lead for Black in Alaska, a project with the Rasmussen Foundation highlighting modern Black Alaskans and the lives that they live. Ian Hartman, who is the author of the book Black Lives, and I've got it right in front of me. I'll read the whole title. Black Lives in Alaska, A History of African Americans in the Far Northwest. Cal Williams has a very large poster of the book, and he is here today as a community organizer and apparently somebody who knows every prominent Black Alaskan from 1950 to 1990. I'm your host, Wesley Early. Next week on Talk of Alaska, we will be talking about cultivating healthy relationships. Till then, this has been Talk of Alaska. Have a great day.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.